The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the show, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. It's good to be back with you. I want to start today with Victor Davis Hanson. He's had a couple of great pieces just in the last day or two. But this first one here, the Weimar America, he says, 2016 is a pivotal year in which a custom reference of a stable West are now disappearing. We talked some yesterday about what's happening in Britain, how many in the leadership here are pinning their hopes on the European Union. Of course, there's a growing movement that opposes that as well, and we'll see how that plays out. But remember yesterday I played that clip from a Londoner who just spoke with disdain about the empire and the rich, illustrious history of this empire, of Great Britain. Hanson says here, we seem to be living in a chaotic age, akin to the mid-1930s, of cynicism and skepticism. And this is coming from a distinguished historian. He knows the lessons of history. He's seeing history repeat itself. We seem to be in a chaotic age akin to the mid-1930s. Government, religion, and popular culture are corrupt and irrelevant. And the world order of the last 70 years has all but collapsed. We're seeing the world order of these past many decades collapsing before our eyes, entering into a chaotic age. Hanson says neither the president nor his would-be successors talk much about the fact that we are now nearing $20 trillion in debt, in an ossified economy of near zero interest rates, little if any GDP growth, and record numbers of able-bodied but non-working adults. You'll remember we talked a couple of weeks ago about the Obama administration's new budget proposal, $4.1 trillion for fiscal year 2017. And in introducing that budget, he talked about just how strong and stable and durable the U.S. economy is. And yet, as he said then and said even more directly yesterday, he has no intention of even trying to balance the budget. He's talked some about reducing deficits. That's only because they skyrocketed up in 2008 and 9 because of the financial crisis. So to go from $1.4 trillion in deficit spending to $700, $600, $500 billion, well, that might represent a cutback, I guess, depending on how you look at it. But it still represents $500-$600 billion of deficit spending every single year. Hundreds of billions of dollars added to the debt. And as Hanson brings out, the fact that we're now near $20 trillion in federal debt. And leave aside all of the unfunded liabilities. Tens of trillions. Taking us even to the hundreds of trillions of dollars. And yet President Obama and his would-be successors, they barely even discuss this. It was brought up yesterday at a White House reception, a gathering of a number of American governors, state governors, there at the White House for a reception. And the following exchange, I don't know who the actual governor is that asked the question of President Obama, but It's what one of the governors asked about the deficit spending, and then this was President Obama's response to the question.
Quick question, something that affects each of us as governors individually is debt. It's crippling to some of us, less so to others. Curious as to your thoughts on the debt of this nation and the lack of any political discourse on either side of the aisle in any of the debates on this issue, and what in the next 10 months your administration can do to draw attention to this, to address it, to change, start to change the course of direction that is currently underway.
Well, we're going to be releasing a budget, so that will be a significant topic of conversation. Maybe I'll just break it out into its component parts. Obviously, the federal government, unlike state governments, does not have in the Constitution that at the end of each year it has to balance its budget. I know that there are those in this room who would probably be for the federal government having a balanced budget amendment. I would not be one of those because in modern economic history, what is clear is that there has to be some flexibility for the federal government, the sovereign nation, to issue debt in order to deal with recession, national emergencies, and so on.
Some of you might want a balanced budget every single year, even an amendment that would enforce it. I would not be one of those, he said. That's, as he continued, talking about the modern economic history. This is the way the progressive mind thinks, that we know so much more today than they did centuries ago. And modern economic theory informs us that we can just keep spending and spending. There has to be some flexibility for the federal government to issue debt so that we can deal with emergencies. And, of course, everything is categorized as an emergency. It's a have to. We must spend on it. And so we keep adding to the debt, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars every year. Never mind the lesson of history that world orders don't last. And Victor Davis Hanson brought that out in his piece. 70 years, the world order of the last 70 years has all but collapsed. We are entering trying times, chaotic times. And yet the spending will continue at these astronomical rates because, well, there has to be flexibility. Of course, you know, we've played this clip before, the following clip, where President Obama, or then Senator Obama, sure didn't say these kinds of things that he said yesterday back when he was campaigning in 2008. Take a listen.
The problem is that the way Bush has done it over the last 8 years is to take out a credit card from the Bank of China in the name of our children, driving up our national debt from $5 trillion for the first 42 presidents. Number 43 added $4 trillion by his lonesome, so that we now have over $9 trillion of debt that we are going to have to pay back. $30,000 for every man, woman, and child. That's irresponsible. It's unpatriotic.
$5 trillion for President Bush, and now, what, $9, $10 trillion more that President Obama has added all by his lonesome? $9, $10 trillion. And just like the senator said in 2008, aren't we going to have to pay this back? Who's going to pay it back? How are we going to pay it back? Well, that comment yesterday, very revealing. It's basically the President of the United States saying that he doesn't believe in a balanced budget because there has to be flexibility. Notice what Senator Lankford, he's the senator from Oklahoma, notice what he had to say back, I think this was on February 10th, a day or two after the president, his administration, released their budget proposal.
No real reform, no real changes, additional debt, additional spending, additional taxes. This is very similar to previous budgets, and we've got to have a change. We continue to add about $500 billion in new deficit spending each year, just keeping this status quo. We're at $19 trillion in debt. The president and I have had this conversation personally, just he and I. He does not believe we should balance the budget. He believes the government should overspend every single year because that stimulates a down economy. I absolutely disagree. This system is completely collapsed and is non-functional. So what I'm proposing is a couple of things. One is we do budgets every 2 years. There's no reason with trillions of dollars at stake that we can't look out over 2 years and do a two-year budget cycle. There are things that can be done. We just have to have the will to actually get it done here.
That was actually a collection of sound bites put together by CBN. I believe he had the interview with the CBN website. The day after, that budget proposal was put forward. But you noticed in that clip, Senator Lankford talked about the private discussions he's had with President Obama, who does, as Lankford said, he does not believe that we should balance the budget. He does not believe it. He believes the government should overspend every single year because this is how you stimulate the economy, and so it will continue. And really, as Victor Davis Hanson brings out, all of the would-be successors are not bringing it up out on the campaign trail because whether Republican or Democrat, whoever it is, well, what's the lesson of modern economic history? The lesson, they think, is to continue spending. Keep spending, and this will prop up the economy. Keep spending, keep adding to the debt, and it will stimulate growth. And meanwhile, as Hanson brings out in his column, you have all of this increase in dependency on the government. All of these able-bodied but non-working adults. Record numbers of them. Record numbers of people on food stamps. Record numbers of people that are receiving benefits from the U.S. government. And a leader that has, from the very beginning, had no intention of ever balancing the federal books, of ever balancing the budget. And so here we are with a system that has completely collapsed. It's totally unfunctional. It's totally unsustainable. It just continues to spend, and then pull in more tax dollars from the private sector and bring down the economy in the process. Crash is coming. A crash is coming. I mean, they're happening in cycles that are just, they're reoccurring in shorter and shorter intervals. So we had the 2008, 2009 financial Armageddon, as some were describing it as. And here we are in 2016. When will the next one happen? And how much worse will it be? And how much time does the United States even have left before it just completely collapses under the weight of this incomprehensible amount of debt? We're going to have to pay it back, Senator Obama said in 2008. You can't just keep running up the credit. We're going to have to pay it back. Well, this other article here by Herbert London, it speaks of America's decline more broadly than just the economy. It's titled Shining City on a Hill, No More. London says the world senses that America has lost its self-confidence. Look at what's on display. Look at the campaigning being done by those candidates for president. Look at what the world is viewing. Look at the spectacle that is the United States. London says a shining city on a hill that President Reagan exalted is enshrouded in fog, it says. Despite many of the qualities it possesses, candidates and critics have conspired to tear down America in the eyes of the world. Well, I wouldn't really agree with that, that it's just the candidates who've tried to tear it down, the reputation. I mean, but look at the hard numbers. Look at what's happening internally. Look at the division. Look at the discontent. It's not a perception that many see because of what some political candidate is out there saying. They see America. They see the nation in decline. They see the nation withdrawing its forces. Everywhere on earth. London says clearly the Obama foreign policy is interpreted by our enemies as a sign of weakness. Retreat and acquiescence are usually viewed that way. Now, however, perceptions run deeper. From Iran to China, there's a belief the culture is being torn apart, he goes on to say. In conversations I've had with Chinese and Japanese nationals, there's a conviction that the United States is suicidal, a nation overdosing on metaphorical Valium. Overdosing, committing suicide. He says this is a viewpoint buttressed by a debt that has risen to $19 trillion. $19 trillion. Extremist political language, a breakdown in the education system at all levels. You may have heard that report at the top of the hour. The breakdown in education. A bunch of spoiled children, pretty much. On campuses in the United States today, indoctrinated with a left-wing agenda that teaches about modern economic history, which is that we should have flexibility, we should have lots of credit cards, we should keep spending. London says, breakdown in education at all levels, families in distress, and a fundamental ignorance of the national past, a fundamental ignorance of history. Darkness is descending on this extraordinary run for the Anglo-American peoples. You look at the once great British empires I discussed yesterday, and now it's being bullied by the European superstate, by the European Union. Mr. Cameron going onto the continent trying to get all of these, well, to get a better deal. And he really didn't get much of anything. And then across the Atlantic, the once greatest superpower on earth, just battered from every direction, from illegal immigration to deficit spending to the shenanigans you see going on college campuses today, race riots, the assault on law enforcement, and on it goes. These once great powers, the United States and Britain, get that book by Herbert Armstrong, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, and you'll see how and why they rose to such an exalted position of prominence. For 70 years, Victor Davis Hanson says, this order was maintained around the world by the British Empire, by the United States of America, the American superpower, particularly since the end of World War II. And now that world order of the last 70 years, and really you could say of the last two centuries, since God bestowed the blessings of Abraham upon our peoples, the United States and Britain, it's all but collapsed. And darkness is descending upon our peoples, upon our nations. Herbert London writes, travel to the Middle East reinforces this opinion, leaving aside comments about Mr. Obama's failed policies. There's a growing belief that there's a cultural cancer metastasizing throughout the American body politic. The fact that a campaign for president on both sides of the political spectrum deals almost exclusively with failure demonstrates this point. This is what many foreigners see in the United States today. They see failure. They see decline. They see darkness. The land of opportunity, of hope and virtue, the beacon of light across the ages for liberty, has foundered on the shoals of self-doubt. A loss of confidence is palpable. China's Xi Jinping, Russia's Putin, and Iran's Khomeini. They recognize this condition in addition to recognizing Mr. Obama's strategy of withdrawal. Yes, indeed, darkness is descending on the extraordinary dominance of the American superpower. The whole world sees it. The whole world is watching. Of course, if you know your history, even your American history, well, London chose that phrase, shining city on a hill, that phrase that President Reagan exalted, that phrase that goes even back as far as the 1600s, even before the nation of America was established. Those founding fathers set out to establish this shining city on a hill, this beacon of liberty and democracy that the whole world could view, that the whole world could aspire to. Think about what Jesus said in Matthew 5. A city that's on a hill cannot be hid. You are the light of the world. Of course, Christ was speaking to his disciples. But the founding fathers drew inspiration from that and from what God said about ancient Israel as well. A city on a hill can't be hid. Matthew 5, verse 15 says, neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it gives light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men, verse 16 says, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. God wants good works. He wants godly conduct to stand out, to be visible. Look at how much this sin-drenched world needs a people, a nation, a family of light. Even as darkness descends on this age, on this world, in fact, go back, as I say, and look at what God said about ancient Israel in Exodus 19. He told them, if you obey my voice, if you keep my covenant, then you're going to be a peculiar treasure, even above all the people on earth. You'll be to me a kingdom of priests. You'll be my holy nation. That ancient nation had a priestly calling. They had a great responsibility to serve God, to serve other nations, to be an example nation, to be a model nation. They failed in that, of course. Let me take you through a few verses in Jeremiah 13. You can read along if you have your Bible nearby. In Jeremiah 13, in verse 11, God says that the houses of Israel and Judah might be unto me for a people and for a name and for a praise and for a glory. That's what God intended. For the houses of Israel and Judah. As my father wrote in the Jeremiah booklet, Jeremiah and the Greatest Vision in the Bible, God created the tribes, later the nations of Israel, for an incredible purpose. They were created to be, he's referring to this verse we just read, they were created to be a praise and a glory to God. The nations of Israel were to cause the whole world to praise and glorify God. That's what this world needs. It needs leadership. It needs righteous leadership, righteous rule. It needs a holy nation, a priestly nation. It needs a light. Well, that's coming. That is coming. You can read from these same prophets and see that even the people of Britain and America, they're going to be an example again. But there's a lot of dreadful, frightening events that are to transpire before that actually happens, before God props up the people of Israel and Judah to be the example nations in the wonderful world tomorrow. You were meant to be a name, or rather for a praise and for a glory, it says. But they would not hear. That's what the rest of verse 11 says, Jeremiah 13 and verse 11. Back up to verse 9. This is Jeremiah 13. It says, "Thus says the Eternal, after this manner will I mar the pride of Israel and the great pride of Judah, this evil people which refuse to hear my words, which walk in the imagination of their heart, and walk after other gods to serve them and to worship them, shall even be as this girdle, which is good for nothing." That's what God thinks of our arrogance, of all of our evils, the disobedience, the idolatry. Well, we're worthless to him. He can't use us. He can't make us a model nation. He can't make us an example nation. And so darkness is descending upon our nations, and we're entering into a chaotic age, as Victor Davis Hanson says. We've been warned. We've been warned by our own leaders. In fact, George Washington, America's first president, he said, "If in the revolution of ages, virtue should give way to a corruption of morals, profligacy of manners, and listlessness for the preservations of the natural and unalienable rights of mankind, then usurpation may arise upon the ruins of liberty." That's George Washington. That's George Washington telling us what would happen if we, these virtues of the founders, would give way to corruption, corruption of morals, profligacy of manners, and so on. John Winthrop, when he spoke of America as this city on a hill way back in 1630, he said this: "We must consider that we will be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us. So that if we deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword throughout the world." That's what's going to happen. We'll be made a byword throughout the world. The whole world is watching. The whole world is watching. They're watching what's happening to Britain and to the United States. They're seeing the sun set on Anglo-American dominance. They're seeing it. And when our nations fall, you can be sure, and prophecy backs this up, of course, that the whole world is going to be plunged right back into the darkness of barbarism and savagery. That's what's coming. As I say, there is hope even for our peoples, the United States and Britain. Jeremiah the prophet spoke of it in chapter 33, when God will restore prosperity and peace to our peoples, when God will make them the positive example they were always meant to be. But it won't be because of the resurrection of the British Empire or Pax Americana. It's going to be because of, well, prophecies like what we discussed yesterday in Daniel 2. The kingdom of God. It'll be the kingdom of God set up and established on this earth, headquartered in Jerusalem. Jerusalem will be the city on a hill. Jerusalem will be the example city where God's family, where godly righteousness will flow in and out of that city, in and out into the nations of this world. And that's what so many prophecies of your Bible describe, and we can't forget about that. We know that darkness is certainly setting in. We know that there's to be one final resurrection of that Holy Roman Empire. And we know that these rising powers, we know that this new world order, that it's going to lead to a lot of chaotic destruction, violence, savagery, barbarism. We're already seeing it. But it's small scale. It's going to get a lot worse. It's going to get a lot worse. That's what we have to prepare for. But even as we do, of course, we've got to be people of vision and see where all of this is leading. It's building to the return of Jesus Christ to this earth and the establishment of God's kingdom on earth. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available at the trumpet.com website and also at the KPCG website too. Send us your email feedback. Send those responses, those emails to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The very best minds in the world are in total ignorance of the unprecedented cataclysm that is about to strike. And why have these prophecies not been understood or believed? Because the vital key that unlocks prophecy to our understanding had been lost. That key is the identity of the United States and the British peoples in biblical prophecy. That key has been found. It is presented to those whose unprejudiced eyes are willing to see in this volume, the United States and Britain in prophecy. The events prophesied to strike the American and British peoples in the next few years are sure. These colossal world events, shrinking the first two world wars into insignificance, will come, but not until the warning has been made available for those whose eyes are willing to see. Request the United States and Britain in Prophecy today. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Victor Davis Hanson talked about the chaotic age that we're now entering into, akin to the mid-1930s. I read that to you in the first segment. He had another piece, just from yesterday as well, I believe, the return of appeasement, collaboration, and isolationism. And in this article, he again talks about the parallels between today and the 1930s, and he gives you a great historical overview here. World War II, he writes, broke out when Nazi Germany invaded Poland on September 1st, 1939. A once preventable war had become inevitable and would soon become global due to three fatal decisions. And so that's what he goes through here in this piece. The three fatal decisions that led to global war. Most infamously, he says, the Western European democracies had appeased Hitler during the late 1930s in hopes that he would quit gobbling up his neighbors. Unfortunately, the Nazis considered Western appeasement as weakness, to be manipulated, rather than magnanimity, to be reciprocated. It says, after the bloodless annexation of Austria and the dismemberment of Czechoslovakia, Hitler assumed that Britain and France would not go to war at all if he went into Poland, or if they did, they would not fight very seriously. And so Hitler just, I mean, he interpreted the appeasement as weakness. This was not a magnanimous gesture by the West, he said, or thought. And so he went on a rampage. But Hansen says here, yet Western appeasement did not alone guarantee the outbreak of World War II. The Germans invaded Poland after a guarantee from Stalin that the Soviet Union would soon join in attacking the Poles from the east. And so there were these back-channel alliances and negotiations that went on as well. That was a fatal consideration or mistake as well. And then the third one here, the third point he brings out, America's isolationism and disarmament also helped prompt another global war. Had the U.S. kept its military strong after World War I, and had it entered into a formal alliance with its former World War I partners, Germany never would have risked a second war against the combined strength of a fully armed Britain, France, and the United States. But you see, those powers went to sleep. Britain, France, and the United States. And they started to disarm, and they started to talk about, well, we're entering into a modern era. And the lessons of modern history are now different than the ones that have happened centuries and centuries ago. Why then, Hansen says, did a relatively weak Nazi Germany between 39 and 41 believe that it could take on much of the world and inspire Axis partners such as Italy and Japan to follow its suicidal lead? The answer is obvious. British and French appeasement, Soviet collaboration, and American isolationism had together, it says, convinced Hitler and his Axis allies that the victors of World War I were more eager to grant concessions at any cost than were the defeated. That's why they went on the rampage. And then Hansen concludes with this: the world of 2016 is eerily beginning to resemble the powder keg of 1939 Europe. Can't we see this as a clear lesson of even recent history? Okay, you talk about modern history. What about this modern history? 1939, not even a century ago, 70-some years ago. The world's looking eerily similar to the way it was back then. It says appeasement, collaboration, and isolationism always prove a lethal mix, past and present. And then you look around the world, and you see, as I said earlier, Britain's just being pushed around by Europe, not getting what it wants, weak. It seems like every other week you hear about a Russian incursion into British airspace, where the Brits have to scramble some jets to try to keep Russian aircraft from encroaching on British airspace. And then look at the United States, most notably in the Middle East. In Libya, I've got this piece here, it was later in my notes, about the U.S. scrambling to contain the growing ISIS threat in Libya. That's from the New York Times. It says the Islamic State's branch in Libya is deepening its reach across a wide area of Africa, attracting new recruits from countries like Senegal that had been largely immune to jihadist propaganda, and forcing the African authorities and their Western allies to increase efforts to combat the fast-moving threat. I mean, they can't contain it. It's spreading. Jihadism, it's spreading even into Senegal. ISIS is finding recruits in Senegal. And so the African authorities, and so the U.S. authorities, they're having to increase efforts just to combat this fast-moving threat. It's all happening so fast. That's the thing that all these articles are bringing out. How many people, though, in the Western world today are even reading it? Or who even care about it? Who even care about what's happening in Syria? Or the Mediterranean region? Or Libya? This piece from the Telegraph, U.S.-backed militia groups now fighting each other in Syria. How about that? For this new age of chaos. The groups we're backing in Syria, they're now fighting against each other. The Telegraph says if anywhere can show the consequences of American foreign policy under President Barack Obama, it may be the small town of Mareya, I guess is how you pronounce it, just north of Aleppo. Says in the course of the last 5 years, it has seen Assad regime tanks roll through from the south, firing shells through its houses. It's been repeatedly attacked from the east by Islamic State forces. On occasion, it's been bombed from the air by the regime and shelled from the ground by ISIS on the same day. Now its rebel defenders are fighting ISIS, the regime, Russian bombers, and a new enemy, the Syrian Kurdish militia. All at once, America's calling for a ceasefire. That's the best that we can do. We're there shouting for a ceasefire, and no one listens. No one cares. It says, to date, every time the international community has placed its faith in regime and Russian promises of good faith, the streets of Aleppo, Homs, and so many other towns and villages across our country have run red with blood. They just totally disregard what America wants or asks for. The Telegraph says it's not new to say that the war in Syria has become a complex mess, spiraling out of control. Analysts and many American diplomats who have left the administration, some in disgust, say that the mess is a consequence of President Obama's decision to support the rebellion against President Bashar al-Assad, but only half-heartedly. And then now you have these rebel forces fighting each other. It's so chaotic. It says he sent weapons to support the rebels, including in Mareya, but he also refused to confront Russia and the regime, who had far more weapons, leaving the rebels lightly armed, sitting ducks. Then he also decided to support the Kurds. He wanted them to fight ISIS, which they did, but they also took on anyone else who stood in the way of the Kurdish mini-state in northern Syria, and that now means rebel areas like Mareya, north of Aleppo, which is between that mini-state's western and eastern halves. As a result, the Telegraph concludes, the town is being fought over by two western proxies. As a result, the town is being fought over by two western proxies. This article, by the way, it quotes a doctor from Mareya, who says the Americans are like a policeman that passes by the scene of a crime and closes his eyes. That makes them a participant in the crime, he says. That's coming from a region or an area that has forces that have been backed by the United States. He now sees the Americans as a policeman that just turns a blind eye to what's really happening. And so, amid all the chaos in Syria, Russia, as I've talked about before on this program, Russia's having its way. Vladimir Putin's winning. He's in charge in Syria. He's in charge of the endgame in Syria, as the Telegraph recently said. Moscow's plan, essentially, is to restore its ally Bashar al-Assad to power. It's quickly becoming a reality that the rest of the world will have to accept. It's whatever Russia wants, the Telegraph says. Whatever Russia wants. That's how this is going to play out. I mean, this has all just happened in the last year or two. The United States bowing out, I mean. And Russia happily taking charge. The Telegraph says the Syrian partial ceasefire brokered in Munich last week by America's John Kerry only served to reinforce this sense of Putin's power. Under the terms of the deal, all combatants were to cease hostilities while humanitarian aid was delivered to rebel enclaves besieged by government troops, except Russia, whose planes have continued bombing terrorist targets, quote-unquote. And since Assad insists that all his enemies are terrorists, The Munich ceasefire effectively means business as usual for Russian and Syrian warplanes. That's what it means for Russia, for Syria, and we should add, as I keep bringing out, for Iran as well. Because Iranian troops are on the ground also in Syria. And for them, for all of those forces, the ceasefire means business as usual. Well, it says here, finally, well, it just talks about the alliances that are being made. It talks about the coming clash between Russia and Turkey. I mean, however it shakes down, going back to what Victor Davis Hanson has written, you see all this confusion and chaos. You see these alliances forming. And it really does take you back to those years, those months, those days leading up to World War II. Let me just conclude with this Telegraph piece on Putin winning in Syria. It says certainly part of Putin's plan in Syria is to distract international attention from his own unfinished intervention in eastern Ukraine. That conflict has cost Russia dearly. International banking sanctions and falling oil prices have sent inflation soaring and halved the value of the ruble. Putin is also ambitious to restore his country's status as a world power, and he'd like to show potential allies in the Middle East and the wider world that Russia stands by its friends. For the first time since the 1980s, Moscow's military and diplomatic backing is something truly worth having. You think about, again, what President Obama said the other day. We played that clip for you. When that reporter asked about, well, look at what Putin's doing. And what do you say to those critics who say it's because of the weak United States that he's just having his way? And yet, the president just shakes his head and says, that's not true at all. We're the ones who outfoxed Putin. He's stuck in a quagmire. He's stuck in a quagmire. He's in a war that he can't afford. It says, for the first time since the 1980s, Moscow's military and diplomatic backing is something truly worth having. Putin's intervention in Syria is an act of reckless geopolitical buccaneering, just like his invasion of Georgia in 2008 and his annexation of Crimea in 2014. I mean, it just continues. Georgia in 08, Crimea in 2014, Syria now in 2016. And nobody's there to stop him. All you have is the United States Secretary of State out there saying, well, we need to have a ceasefire. We need to stop firing. We need to tone it down. And that is something the state of Iran, the state of Russia, Syria, Bashar al-Assad, they take that to mean, well, let's just carry on. It's business as usual. Well, meanwhile, in Europe, we haven't talked enough about Europe of late, except with respect to this oncoming crisis with the UK and its membership, the referendum in late June. But the continued problems with the flood of migrants, debt crises, the surging nationalism. This is all discussed in an op-ed piece in the New York Times from, I guess, the other day, Sunday maybe. The European Dream, a requiem. Confronted with all of these crises, it says Europe is paralyzed. And the element most dangerous to the European dream is barely noted. A rift is widening between France and Germany over how to pursue prosperity and security, their deepest national interests. The article then talks about just how closely these two have worked in the years that followed World War II. For 30 or 40 years, I mean, they both had a comparable power. They both worked together toward a common market. But now there's this crisis between these two. How is it going to sort out? It gives some interesting history here with respect to the early 1990s and how that German reunification undid that balance from the previous 30 or 40 years, where Germany then, after German reunification, it became the juggernaut, as this article brings out. And it's interesting, given what we've said so many times regarding Revelation 10 and verse 6, and entering into that period of no more delay after Herbert Armstrong's death in January of 1986. No more delay. Look at how much things accelerated after that event. And then the wall coming down, German reunification. And how Germany then became the one, the strong man in Europe, you could say. Of course, we're waiting for the actual leader, the Daniel 8 man, to emerge out of the heart of Europe as well. And that's how this article concludes, talking about these crises and how they're dealt with. And it's going to boil down to a matter of leadership. It says in the 1990s, François Mitterrand and Helmut Kohl, like Adenauer and De Gaulle before them, could work together in part because they had experienced the ultimate alternative, the horrors of war. But those giants have long left the stage. There exists today neither any guiding program nor true solidarity, and historical memories have grown very short. Miss Merkel and Mr. Hollande are more than ever focused on their own national conundrums: for France, how to control terrorism; for Germany, how to treat refugees. And so these crises, they aren't going away. And it's coming down to a matter of weeks. We're reaching a breaking point. You saw it, as we discussed yesterday, or you see it, with respect to Britain and its membership in the EU. You see it with the migrant crisis, the refugee crisis in Germany. You see it with all these jihadist attacks. You see it with the surging nationalism. It's building to a breaking point. It's building to a radical restructuring of things in Europe. It's building to the point of the strong man arriving on the scene, just as is prophesied in the book of Daniel. So many trends, so many prophecies to keep track of. Callum Wood had an excellent summarization just today at thetrumpet.com. It had to do more with just the Middle East, but he's just basically talking about all the things that have happened just in the first 2 months of this year. Of this year, it makes your head spin. When you take not just the Middle East, but then also Europe, the kings of the East, Russia and China, and then what's happening to Britain, what's happening to the United States. It's a lot to keep up with, for sure. Which is why we have the website, thetrumpet.com, all the literature that we produce, the Key of David program, the Trumpet Daily videos, and then, of course, these programs on KPCG, the Trumpet Daily radio show, Trumpet Hour. It's a lot to keep up with. But God certainly has given us the means to get the message out, to help you stay informed, to help you understand your world, to help you prepare for what's coming. These are exciting times. And when you think of it in terms of Bible prophecies being fulfilled, these are exciting times for sure. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3. On the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream's available at thetrumpet.com and also the KPCG website. Tomorrow I'll be off at a conference in London, so Brad McDonald and Richard Palmer will be filling in. You can look forward to that, and then I'll hope to be back with you again on Thursday. Keep sending us those emails. Send them to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. and we'll see you, I'll see you on Thursday.